What I decided on to take up of the list of topics that I have for this year, the subject on suffering. And I'm afraid that my motives for doing so weren't altogether very good. It is because I think it is a subject that I dreaded most of all to have to speak on, then I thought, well, I'd rather have this over with, and then I haven't got to worry about it. But when I came to preparing for it, instead of the usual stacks of notes, all I could write was that little bit. And I think that would be partly because I was tired and perhaps preoccupied with various other things at the moment. I found it very difficult to prepare. And you're thinking again, is it a subject that you can prepare in a kind of a cold-blooded and hard-hearted way? Although I haven't known a great deal of suffering in my life in the real sense, yet I have seen a great deal of suffering. And I have always found this to be a very humbling thing. I've also found it a very dangerous thing to talk about, in that if you speak about suffering like this to an open congregation, you may be tackled after your talk by somebody who has had or has an overwhelming grief. And I can think of some instances like that now, that if I should openly on a Sunday talk about the uses and merits of suffering, that I wouldn't get off scot-free, that I know that there will be a little row of people waiting for me whose grief is overwhelming them. Then you have a difficult task of trying to tell them that there is some purpose, and they look at you with horror in their eyes. Do you need to tell me that there was any purpose in taking my son away, in taking my daughter away? And so you're just left standing, and you just don't know what to say. So it's a subject that you can see from just beginning like that, that it is one that fills you with much apprehension. And yet somehow, somewhere, there is a deep secret there. In one of the epistles, and now I think I'm right, yes, in Philippians, there's a verse that has disturbed me. In chapter 1, verse 29. For unto you it is given, in the behalf of Christ, not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake. And the man who's saying it knows something about it, having the same conflict which he saw in me, and now here to be in me. That Paul here is talking about some suffering, whatever it may be. And he said, it seems to be our lot, he said, that we have the privilege not only of believing in the Lord Jesus Christ, but there seems to be also an involvement with suffering. But you might think, what merit is there in suffering? Now, as a minister, and I'm sure that not only as any individual, I suppose you can sometimes see gross and dreadful suffering, but as a minister, I see a great deal of it. And quite a big proportion of my life is taken up with people in deep distress who desire to talk to somebody or to see something. Illness is sometimes that you would say, well, if a friend of mine has got that, well, I'll go because he's my friend. But you wouldn't go otherwise. Say a cancer ward. Not just a cancer that is tidy. Well, it is inward, but when it takes on dreadful forms, and that you have to go and see that person, and they might say to you, why? Why am I suffering like this? And you've got to answer them, and you've got to give them an honest answer. You've got to be truthful. Well, this surely isn't an easy thing. Well, what would you say to them? Or if you, say, see somebody else who is not particularly suffering in a physical way, but you're seeing that they are suffering in some mental torment or mental anguish, and they're going through something that when they unveil the story to you, that you think, well, however can they live? However can they survive this kind of thing? Now I can think of instances, and here I have to be careful, you see, because the minister is a person whom people share with, and he must be much safer, especially today, the Bank of England, wasn't it? He must be saying. And so I have always tried, as far as in me lies, to avoid personal illustrations. You know, lots of ministers are delighting giving account of conversions and so on. Now I don't, and I'll tell you why. Because I think that the dealings of God with us are something so precious and so sensitive that I cannot see how the Holy Spirit can ever trust a person who is untrustworthy. So there must be locked things. So I can only point at general things in that way, although it would be far more wonderful and perhaps more effective in a way to give you actual illustrations. But I can think of a grief now by a person that when this person told me, I just looked at that person and I thought, how can you live? How can you live? And a most strange thing happened. Somebody came to me who had a problem. It wasn't much of a problem. But, you know that hymn that says, how many, about the hindrances, what is that hymn that talks about it? 4-6 something, isn't it? Is it 4-6-2? You know, it really strikes home here. How many know words, I think again, words flow apace when you complain, and fill your fellow creatures here with a sad tale of all your care. And you get folk, don't you? And I'm sure they are real cares. And I remember one person who had, what was a real care to them? I didn't want to show my impatience because it was nothing very important. And this person turned to the one who'd shared with me earlier in the week. He said, look at that person. She's no worries. She's just ordinary. And I thought, if only you knew. If only you knew the anguish that person goes through every single second of the day. I couldn't say anything. I could just turn and say, now come on, what's your problem now? Let's talk about it. Never mind anybody else. Do you see what I mean, Elvin? That it's a realm, isn't it? A realm that, when you go into it, it's very difficult to say to people, God has his purpose. But of this, I am convinced. If you are a believer, then whatever happens in your life, if you're truly a believer, you must settle this one thing, that you believe that all things work together for good to them that love God. Now you've got to settle that. Now, that isn't something you settle, oh yes, okay, I'm doctrinal, you know, and I do be doctrinal nevertheless, and say, I've got my doctrines right, I believe in the sovereignty of God, I read Pink on the sovereignty of God as well, you know, I'm sure it must be all right, so that I'm really with it. Knowing the sovereignty of God and accepting his sovereignty in your life. You see, you and I can have great plans for ourselves, can't we? Great plans. Instances like this that are not harmful to give you. A young girl who was becoming a missionary. You hardly ever see a young man become a missionary, do you? It has to be a young girl. A young girl becoming a missionary. And she was due to go on the foreign field. And the week before she went, she felt unwell. And she was struck down with polio. That was 18 years ago. And she's still there. Lying on her back. Now you might say, well, what can you say to her? You could say she decided to give her all to God. And what did God do? He afflicted her and laid her aside. Or another example of the only child in one family, a lovely girl, who just described this way, that wherever she went, she left the Savior of Christ. That she fights hard to work amongst the Dinka tribe in southern Sudan. And it's difficult because a primitive, although an intelligent people, a very primitive people. And eventually when she manages to get there, and no mission society would really support her, how she got there on her own and the struggles of this. She has sleeping sickness, dies, and is buried within the same day at the age of 30. How do you talk to the parents? What do you say to them? An unbelieving father, if she hadn't had this so-called conversion, she'd still be here today. Can you hear it? You can hear it, can't you? It's when suffering comes that you'll get the abuse of the world, and sometimes, sadly, the anger of Christians too. So you have to settle in your mind this one thing. He doeth all things well. That he is sovereign, and that his sovereign will is the main thing in your life. Now, I would say that, I'm not saying that this is the classical order of things now in regarding the value of suffering. I'm only saying to you, as I have tried to prepare how things have occurred to me, if I wrote down to our proper notes, I am sure that I'll have to rethink and title and give you one A, B, C. The only thing I found that when I went into the subject, I couldn't find an A, B, or a C, all right? It was not that kind of a subject. But I felt in my heart, the one thing I have to settle then is this. He is sovereign, the Lord reigneth. In my own tiny little life, not that this is of any importance at all, but I'm a person that I set my course and I like to think, I'm getting there and I'm terribly willful, I know this. And God had to break this will in me constantly. And I said, that's where I'm going and I will get there. And the times when I have felt that it is important that I should keep well and be on top of things, that he has laid me aside, are getting now rather monotonous. You see, they're coming so often. And I can think of one time particularly, a very critical period in the history of this church. You see, a church is like a big boat, isn't it? You know, it's slowly, it's moving past perilous rocks, then it's been still for a while, and it gives a little lurch forward. And you've got to not say, oh, it's not the kind of church I like, I'll go and do something else. This is a church you've got. These are the people you have. And so this is a church that you must go along with. And then I can remember one time when it was a very important period. I was taken ill again. And I can remember coming round from one of these little coma efforts in the hospital and feeling so frustrated. So frustrated. I'm not saying why, but thinking it. I said, well, Lord, it's Saturday night. I mean, how much notice is this for a preacher on Sunday? That kind of talk. And how he answered me was a hand on my shoulder. There was no one there, but he was there. And I knew all was well. And so I wrote a hymn, my first. All was well. See, the sovereignty of God. Then suddenly, you know, I think in times like this that he has to approach you with his sovereignty. And he said, do you remember who's king? Do you remember who I am? That I order all things well. And I do all things perfectly. Now, what are his dealings in this realm of suffering? Now, let's think of some now. Supposing we talk of the one in Hebrews particularly, that hymn we sang touched very much on it now, didn't it? What number was the hymn? Was it 365? That will not murmur or complain beneath the chastening rod. But in the hour of grief or pain, can lean upon its God. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Have you thought of that? Chastening rod, comforting staff. Thy rod and staff, they are for my spiritual comfort. But will not murmur or complain beneath the chastening rod. But in the hour of grief or pain, can lean upon its God. Now, if you look at Hebrews with me, chapter 12. Now, I'm not very sure of the verse. Now, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruits of righteousness by them which are exercised thereby. All right? No chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous. Now there are some sufferings, they are because we have misbehaved. I wonder if you'd agree with that. There is such a thing, isn't there, as disobedience in a Christian's life. And willful and persistent disobedience. So what can we expect then? We must expect, isn't we, the dealings of God. Now in these dealings of God, he might first of all, you see, he might first of all say, well, I persuade you this way and I guide you this way and we don't take any notice. Or we are blessed in the word and we feel this is what I should be doing or this is what I shouldn't be doing. Then, after that, you might say like this, well, I will do this and we're still disobedient. And in that disobedience, God begins to deal with us. And the dealings become severe. But he's a gracious God. Now this is where the trouble comes. Are we willing, you see, that when we are chastened, by God, when we are chastened by God, to respond to him. Now the argument taken in the Hebrews epistle is this, that no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but it is for a good purpose, and that parents with their children rebuke them. And if you really love your children, you find it very, very difficult to chasten. I find it very difficult. I find that I want to say to my boy or my girl, I say like this to them, now look, I mean this, and I find that I don't really mean it. And after I said that, I begin a punishment or deprive them of something, and I find that I want to give in. But then I remember, I want my children to be good children, I want them to be well behaved, and because of that, I persist in what I'm doing. So that although I find it hard to do, I will persist. And the purpose and the motive it is that it might make them into better children. God deals with us like that. If fathers in the flesh eventually see sense, and eventually are willing to chasten their children, can you not see, he's saying, that when you go spiritually astray, then I too must rebuke you and chasten you. So there are some sufferings. So you can have, look at an illness if you like. Or it needn't be an illness, but the illness is an easy one to take. You can be ill just because you're physically ill. Right? Because the world is full of germs. Right? Just for that reason. You can be ill because Satan's attacking you. You can be ill because God is ill. Can't you? And it can be, in a sense, sometimes all three. Put it this way. You know when Joseph was put in the pit, Joseph was in the pit. And on one side of the pit, you could say there were two forces. The anger and the lust of his brothers, and Satan, driving them. Alright? On the other side of the same pits, God could work it for good. That's right, isn't it? There are levels, let's say, of the same thing. So here are the brothers, and here is Satan, doing all they can to destroy this traffic. God, on the other hand, allowing it, but allowing it for some ultimate purpose that he has in view. Sometimes it is purely a satanic thing on its own, you see, it can be. But there are times too when God is using it. And if it is a believer, it is always that he has it for some purpose. Now when there are some illnesses then, they may be there because of the fall, and they are there because of the fall, and sufferings are generally because of the fall. But nevertheless, God is going to use this like he used Cyrus for Israel's good. When he rebuked Israel, part of doing his good is rebuking. Now then, I think we've got to accept this, that sometimes during our lives there is the rebuke of God. Now then, it depends upon us in one sense how long that's going to last. How quickly do we learn? Or it's really not like that. How deeply must we know? Because when God gives us a lesson, he deals with us in such a way that we might learn deeply that lesson. And so it hasn't got to be taught a second time. So that his rebuke, I think, is at the far end of the scale. You know, there are many, many opportunities. Come on now, do this. And he speaks to us all along. And many, many times. But we persistently disobey. And then at last he says, you leave me no alternative. I must chasten you. Now then, the chastening will be thorough. You see what I mean? It will be absolutely thorough. God doesn't do things in half measures. So there are some afflictions and some situations that you and I might find ourselves in, that we find them very hard, but deep in our hearts, we know that it's for our good. Now then, how will I know when God is chastening me? Now this is the difference between an attack which is just a vicious satanic attack on its own, or an attack which Satan is involved in it because of suffering and evil in itself, but God also is using it for his good ends and purposes. How will I know when God is there? Now, I can tell you, right, that there is a way that you can discover this. Now, it is this way. when Satan strikes, he strikes and there is no relief. There is no comfort. When God strikes, there are two hands. There is a hand that strikes us, and there is the hand that holds us. And you'll experience in the same events the wounding and the balm of God. All right, because the end he has in view is not our destruction, is not our elimination. The end he has in view is a deeper spiritual life and more godliness and obedience in our hearts and our lives. Now then, we'd prefer not to go through that. And that you have it in the Lord's Prayer. You know, when it comes to lead us not into temptation. Do you remember when we went through the Lord's Prayer in church? Remember the meaning for that word? Lead us not... Now, what is temptation? See, the word has gone to mean recently, in the last centuries or so, it has a kind of a popular meaning. So if you and I say, I'm tempting a person, we always think it's detrimental, don't we? But if you think of the word, it hasn't necessarily got to mean detrimental. It all depends, doesn't it? If you're tempting a person for good or tempting a person for evil. It's what your motives are, what you're doing. Another word, instead of tempting, is testing. So if I could go along and say to a person, I'm going to test you, does that necessarily mean that I'm doing it for an evil purpose, that I'm testing to see if you'll fall? It doesn't necessarily follow. I'm testing also to see regarding good things. So you could say testing in this sense, that testing means a period when I'm going to be dealt with, not for an evil end, like temptation seems to imply, but for, if it's by Satan, it's for an evil end. If it's by God, it's for a good end, so God can tempt me. God can test me. Now, testing of God, although it's hurtful, in one sense it hurts us and wounds us, yet it is for a good end. Nevertheless, even though it's good what he does, lead us not into temptation. If it's possible, Lord, I prefer to learn without being tested. If it's possible, Lord, I prefer to come through without being tried. So our prayer is where he said, when you pray, pray this daily, or as often as you will. Lord, lead me not into that kind of thing. I don't like examinations, Lord. I don't like trials. Help me to learn before then. The trouble is we say that and we don't mean it, and we still go our stubborn way. So he is compelled to lead us into temptation, into testing, in order that it might yield the peaceable fruits of righteousness to them which are exercised thereby. That's one purpose of suffering. Now then, the verses we looked at on Wednesday, if you were there, do you remember in 2 Corinthians 4, verses 17 and 18. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Now then, I don't want to dwell on it again because there's too much here because, you know, and it'll be rather boring for you here on Wednesday, nevertheless. But just to draw one thing, and I can't ignore this verse in this kind of context, is that here suffering is looked upon in another way again. That he says a Christian should be a person whose eyes are in a certain direction. And he will call affliction light and momentary, because he has an eternal view of things, and because he knows of the tabernacle, this tabernacle, if it were dissolved, he has something firmer and better, a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. But he knows such things. But the phrase I'd like to take out is this, worketh in you. Now then, there is now suffering, as far as I can see, which is not testing, which is not a rebuke, Because it would be rather sorrowful, wouldn't it? And I've been inclined to do this sometimes. And every time we find something causing us a time of grief or sorrow or pain, whatever it may be, you might say, well, what have I done? Where have I been disobedient? And I've been interpreted always in the same way. And, you know, by some people always ignoring it as being God dealing with them. You know, we're living in such an age, I think the danger is to go that way rather than the other. In a sense, you know, there's a great catastrophe today. Even Christians become anxious and say, well, Lord, this is not going to do your cause any good. Even Christians say that. And unbelievers will say, where is your God now? And especially with the tragedies that are particularly heart-rending that we've known in the last few years in our land. And we feel this is going to create a problem rather than a help. Yet, two or three centuries ago, if there was a national catastrophe, people would say, God is angry with us. We are an undeserving and an unfaithful people. We have offended our God. So you have the two extremes. You always seem to interpret it then as the anger of God. Whereas now, we don't interpret it as that at all. So when we suffer affliction today, we never think of the possibility that we should be rebuked. Now, all I'm saying is I don't want us to go to the extreme of thinking we've always been rebuked. But I think we ought oftener to recognize that God does deal with us, and we are being rebuked. Now then, it isn't always rebuke. There is another, that he wants me to move on. Now there are some lessons that can only be learnt in the school of affliction. Now I lay myself wide open there. And I believe that's true. Now, do you remember the illustration? Shall I give you an illustration, a real popular Welsh preacher's illustration? And the Welsh of you who speak Welsh anyway will know it. Probably you all will, because I probably use it once or twice, but it's one that is worth reminding you all of, in any case, because it makes a point. Philip Jones, or Pop Cowell, he was what they call the 20-minute preacher. He'd never refuse to preach more than 20 minutes, and he's a popular preacher, and he was an actor as well, so a clever kind of person. I don't know where you sit spiritually, no idea, regarding what we know as evangelicalism and so on. But he would be classed, I suppose, as the kind of evangelicalism that went about then. And he had some very good illustrations, nevertheless. And now, how true the illustration is in itself, I don't know, but the point made by this is a good one, of two shores in South America. And let me get it right now, left and right, east and west. The western shore is the Pacific Ocean, that's right. And the eastern is the Atlantic. So on the eastern shore, the Atlantic shore, the rocks are rounded and smooth, and you can walk in them. But on the western shore, the Pacific, they are harsh, jagged, rugged rocks, terrible to walk on. The reason apparently was this, that the Pacific Ocean, by virtue of its name, or what you might say, tells you something of its story. That it was a more peaceful thing altogether. And so they went the storms in the same kind of numbers, I suppose, pounding the shores of that shore. But on the other, many a storm, many a terrible gale, and the storms there had been smooth. He says, storms do something to you. Now that's a good point, isn't it? We met people who have never suffered. They have no patience with illness. They just can't really think what it's like. They have no patience with illness. They don't want to talk about those things. And if people are suffering, they never think of giving them much time, or very seldom do they. They're hard people. Jagged, jagged rocks. But when a person has suffered, it does make you very kind. Now, just to give a tiny illustration here, I don't know what suffering is really, but I've had kidney trouble and back trouble in the last few months. And as far as I'm concerned, it's been absolutely horrible. And pain until you're completely preoccupied with pain. You know, you can think of nothing else but your pain until you have become pain. You can't enjoy anything, somebody might say. And it just so happened, actually, I've had a lovely gift. Well, in the height of this, somebody brought me a new shells for my city. I couldn't be the slightest bit interested. And I've been looking forward to seeing them. because you're so involved with your pain. Gone now, mostly. But you know, it's maybe very kind to people who have pain all the time. People who have unrelieved pain. Now, I'm just thinking of an example like this. I'm using this because it's so ordinary in a way. And I think of the kidney thing. I have two morphine injections, and you know, it just didn't touch it. It just didn't touch the pain. And then I know that there are people in that kind of pain all the time. You know, in some dreadful forms of illnesses, and you think, this is terrible. This is terrible. They have no dawn. They have no relief. And then if you grumble about anything, you feel jolly ashamed. You really do. Because plain, straightforward pain is a vile thing. And if you had a little of it, it makes you very kind to people who are in constant pain. Alright? Makes you more hundred. Alright? Not as jagged. Not as harsh. It can work out in all sorts of ways. You're impatient with the driver in front of you. Then you see that he's bright haired and getting on. And you think, well, what will I be like at that age? Alright? Or you're in a hurry somewhere and there's some middle aged ladies going rather slow. And they look a bit dramatically. And you just can't be bothered, you push past them, you think, oh no, they're in pain. What will I be like when I'm that age? It makes us wondrous kind, even on a human level. Now then, what I want to draw from that is this. There are some things we can only learn in that school. Because there are some stages that we must reach spiritually that we've got to be taught it in a proper and a practical way. Now then, do you remember I used an illustration on Wednesday that, you know how we all love the sunshine and we don't like the rain, we don't like the cold winds, and we don't like this kind of thing. And yet, if you have a place that is all sunshine, you get a Sahara Desert. It's a terrible thought, isn't it? But I think that sunshine brings a desert. But the sunshine benefits those who've known the rain. Right? Sunshine benefits them. Now what does this mean? It means that in my spiritual life, I need more than sunshine. It means that I have to have some pretty cold days, rainy days, in order that the sunshine will do me good. So there are some things I must learn in the hard school of experience. In that verse there, he says, when this is happening, what do I recognize? Not that I am being rebuked this time, but that what I'm going through worketh in me an exceeding weight of glory. That it's actually doing something. It isn't even just this, where I can say, when I weigh the glory to come, and when I weigh the suffering of today, well off, you see, it goes down in favour of the glory. Granted, that is there. That comparison is there. But there is more than that there. Not only is that true, but the thing itself worketh in me. That I will come out of this affliction, whatever kind of affliction it is now. And don't let's be preoccupied with just illness, by the way, alright? That I will come out of this, maybe a period of dreadful isolation and loneliness. And I can just say I know what that is at this particular moment in the position we are in, we won't be enlarged on this. You realize that even worketh in you. It's doing a work in you. There is something going on in you for your eternal good and the weight of glory, even in the affliction, that you will come out the other side of that affliction the richer, the deeper, the better. You see? It's a wonderful thing. It really is a wonderful thing. Now then, afterwards, you see, we can see, and in this we can see, it is for my eternal weight of glory and good. There's a lot we can say on that, but leave that for a minute. Now, where can I be helped in all this? Now, another verse from Hebrews, and that's chapter 12, right now. Did I say Hebrews? I meant to say Hebrews, no. Chapter 12, verse 3. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest he be wearied and faints in your minds. Now, there is so much you can learn from that, but isn't there also this? You see, in Scripture, you can learn the obvious doctrinal truths, you can learn experimental things, you can learn, relearn, and learn again, can't you? So you can look at the same passages, and you are not ignoring the basic fundamental lessons there, but you're also bringing out the secondary ones. And I think here is a very wonderful secondary one, is that it's asking us to consider the Lord. Now, in what context? In the context of running the Christian race. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. So God has set a race for me. I've got to run it with patience, and I've got to run with patience the race that is set before me. All right? So there needs to be a real willingness there. Now, even if it is not, supposing the race set before me is the bed of our polio missionary. You see what I mean? The race that is set before me. I thought I was going that way. Suddenly I find that it was not that track, but this track I had to run on. But I run with patience that race that is set before me. We take it up for granted now. Looking where? Unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of faith, the great highlights of the truth can be wrought in there. Who for the joy that is set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. And he did that. Now, in order to achieve that great aim, he went through all this. Endure the cross, the insult of some stupid little king like Herod. Well, when you think of it, you know, it'll suffer and Satan the upstart, but honestly, in a little country, on a little planet called Earth, and he is cheeky and rude, and, you know, it's dreadful for him. And some silly little men dressed up in long gowns and long faces and representing so-called religion, spitting and mocking and saying, others he saved, himself he can't save. The thing becomes ridiculous. So I'm finding that kind of gowns irritates me more and more after it did yesterday, where I was in some kind of meeting somewhere, or the day before. And there's a, you're just dressed up. I mean, listen, I needn't be dressed up, all right? It wasn't the kind of his ecclesiastical law that he had to. And it was a silly, you know. It was a silly. He didn't even think, you know. And there he was, all this stuff in towns and gowns. I mean, I felt like saying, you silly little man. You know? I really felt like saying that. I was dressing up in long frocks like that. You know, it was just plain stupid. You could call them gowns. It was where they put frocks. Dresses. So, it was silly. Just plain silly. And the Lord had to see these men performing with their long little things on their bells and their gowns and their trinkets, as if they knew God, and they knew nothing. And they just knew nothing. He endured that. And then you see the friends around him, those whom he trusted, they just ran away, except for John. And he gave Peter, big broad-shouldered Peter, acting like a baby. God, honestly, that. Not even showing ordinary human courage. I don't even know him, he said. Never seen him. I'm not one of them. And then you think of Judas. I mean, of all ways to betray him with a kiss, is a terrible thing to do. Yet he endured that. And then some silly little soldiers, just plain regulars, all right, with 30 mouths and talk normally, having to push about the clean body of Jesus Christ. And you can imagine, I can remember, the illustrations of Regan, that kind of thing, of how the world thinks of bodies and what he had to put up with. Now, how could he do it, if we can speak like that? He looked forward, and he saw something, and it's in that verse, endure the cross, despising the shame, and he sat down the right hand of the throne of God. Look, who for the joy that was set before him, the shore was near. The shores of all the purposes of God fulfilled. The shore was near. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the contradiction. Good word, isn't it? Contradiction of sinners. Now then, what do we get from that? Verse 3, consider him. Just consider him. Now what do I consider? Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. Why should I consider him? when he hits the nail on the head. Sometimes you're weary. Sometimes you faint in your mind. See what he's getting at? Oh yes. This race that is set before you isn't just a little plaything just for you to amuse yourself. It's a race. It's a hard race. And you've got to run well here. And you've got to run steadfastly here. And sometimes the tracks go through perilous places. Sometimes they go through bitterly cold places, but you've got to go on. Sometimes they go through lonely places, but you've got to go on. And so he's saying, you see, sometimes you are weary. And sometimes your heart and your mind nearly faints within you. And the afflictions that come along this way, and you are gripped with it all. And what do? Consider him. And that's the answer. So now you may go to a Christian who is going through something that you cannot give him the answer to. But you can say to him, consider him who endured such contradiction of sins. Consider him. Now this is the secret of it all. What do I do when I consider him? He's the Son of God. He's by my side. He will comfort me more now than any other time. He will hold me tighter here, hold me more fast here than at any other time. I will see glimpses of him here that I would not have seen elsewhere. And you can write things like this if you like. I saw a new vision of Jesus, a view I'd never seen there before. Things you hadn't seen before. You'd look, you'd know your doctrines. You could have decided Burkhoff backwards, maybe, you see, if you're very clever. And, or Calvin forwards, you know, you could. And, but you see, but I've seen a new vision of Jesus. A view I've just not seen there before. Now, lead me not into temptation. I don't like these trials, but nevertheless, I say this. But whatever they are, but I do find that looking back, I would not have been without them. Do you see the point? Looking back, we would not have been without them. Well, that's all, really. Now then, it's very difficult to say any more than that, because applying that is most difficult. Because I say quite honestly then, I don't think another person can really teach another person regarding the value of these things. I think that the teacher in the school of suffering must be God himself. Must be. And he must wean us from our rebellion. And it is he alone who can show us the value of these things. I suppose the only help that we can give to one another is to say that the Christian should have his priorities right. The person who is completely convinced of the sovereignty of God and of the absolute wisdom of God's dealing, and that he never makes mistakes, and that he is always absolutely right. Convinced of that, and then I would say then he has got the beginning of wisdom. And whatever God's dealings are with us, that we can say that place that surely that King David got to when he said, even though I walk through the valley, even there are many valleys he's really referring to here, but there's this one even, the worst of the rocks, in one sense, more frightening. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, even there, I will fear no evil. I may fear it, but I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. And then he says, ah, but that's sentimental. Somebody might say, it's all very well to say you have a lovely present with you. David says, you don't understand what I mean. I know what it means for God to be with me. His rod, his staff, they comfort me. You see? Convinced that whatever the dealings of God may be with us, whatever they are, it is always good to be dealt with by God. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Why? Because I know thou preparest for me and preparing me for that place. That he has in view my ultimate spiritual